and all the seething discontent over Vietnam seemed to collide with each other in a stormy turbulence. And Manson, in his rhetoric, borrowed heavily from these fermentations. And we certainly know from the unerring rearview mirror of 25 years later that Manson and these murders did not represent a foreboding extension of the direction in which the anti-establishment movement was going. The sociological implications and legacy, then, of the murders may be no more than that they constituted a reaffirmation of the verity that whenever people surrender their minds and souls to a dictatorial cult figure, there comes a point for the followers when it is too late to turn back. And as with the masses following the despots of history, whatever direction he goes in, he takes them with him. With the Reverend Moon, for example, it is a life of sleeping on floors and eating mush while he buys more yachts and mansions. With the Reverend Jim Jones and David Koresh, it was suicide. With Manson, murder. In searching for a more prosaic explanation for the seemingly timeless resonance of the case, observers have pointed to the fact that Manson and his minions may have murdered as many as 35 people, and already had plans to murder celebrities like Frank Sinatra, Liz Taylor, Richard Burton, Steve McQueen, and Tom Jones. But apart from the planned celebrity killings, murders by other mass murderers numbering in the 20s and one in the 30s, John Wayne Gacy, 33, have been confirmed. Others have spoken of the brutality of the murders, but though few, there have been murders even more brutal. Still others have pointed to the prominence of the victims, but they weren't that prominent. Although all of these elements have undoubtedly contributed to the durability of the case, I believe the main reason for the continuing fascination with it, at such a late date, is that the Manson murder case is almost assuredly the most bizarre mass murder case in the recorded annals of crime. And for whatever reason, people are magnetically fascinated by things that are strange and bizarre. If these murders had never happened, and someone wrote a novel with the same set of facts and circumstances, most people would put it down after a few pages. Because as I understand it, to be good fiction, it has to be somewhat believable. And this story is just too far out. There is another compelling reason for the continuing fascination with the case. The very name, Manson, has become a metaphor for evil, catapulting him to near mythological proportions. Charles Manson has come to represent the dark and malignant side of humanity. And again, there is a side to human nature that is fascinated by pure, unalloyed evil. On a lesser scale, why are there so many popular books and crime shows on television dealing with murder, evil's ultimate act? Across the water, one recalls George Orwell's 1946 essay, Decline of the English Murder, in which he speaks of the pleasure he and his countrymen receive from reading about a sensational murder in the comfort of their drawing rooms. Since we place so much value on human life, why do we glorify, in a perverse sort of way, the extinguishment of life? The answer to that question, whatever it is at least a partial answer to why people continue to be fascinated by Hitler, Jack the Ripper, Manson. As with evil, fright also has its allure. The quality of a horror movie, we know, is generally considered to be directly proportionate to the extent to which it terrifies. Manson, of course, delivers on the fright meter like perhaps no one else. His Hitlerian stare fixed upon us from places as diverse as the television screen and the covers of magazines, to the underground albums of his music and his wax frame at Madame Tussaud's in London. "People worry about this man the way they worry about cancer and earthquakes," a reporter wrote in 1979. Just recently, he quotes a California state prison official, "A New York woman phoned to say she had a dream that Manson made a break and started going after Jews. She wanted to make sure there's no chance he can escape." Los Angeles Times columnist Howard Rosenberg calls Manson America's preeminent boogeyman. Not only were the murders he ordered the type one doesn't even see in horror movies, but Manson, like no other mass murderer of this century, has added a shivering new dimension to the fright quotient. his diabolical and singular talent for getting others, without asking any questions, to kill complete strangers for him at his command. Dr. David Abramson, a noted psychiatrist who has studied the history of violence in America, says he has never heard of any parallel for such a phenomenon. With other prominent mass murderers, from Charles Starkweather, David Berkowitz, Henry Lee Lucas, Charles Whitman, and Richard Speck to Ted Bundy, from Juan Corona, Dean Corll, Adolfo de Jesus Constanzo, John Wayne Gacy, and Richard Ramirez to Jeffrey Dahmer, without exception, they committed the murders by themselves or participated with others in the act. The fright generated by these heavyweights of homicide's rogue gallery then was always finite. Because of Manson's ability to control others and get them to vent his spleen on society for him, the probability of death has always been exponential, and therefore much more frightening. Some have compared Manson with the Reverend Jim Jones and David Koresh. Although to their followers, Jones, Koresh, and Manson were all messianic, and each possessed the uncommon ability to totally control and dominate the lives of those who believed in them, the comparison ends there. During the final moments of Jones and Koresh, in a state of dementia, they ordered the suicide of their followers, then proceeded to take their own lives also. Turning their power over others inward by ordering and participating in mass suicide is a far cry from Manson driving down dark streets with his followers randomly looking for homes into which he could send them to commit human slaughter. Prior to the last days of Jones and Koresh, there is no evidence that either had ordered others to murder anyone for them. With Manson, murder was his religion, his credo, his way of life. As Paul Watkins said, death is Charlie's trip. Derivatively, Manson's slavishly obedient followers had come to share this hellish passion. Telling cellmates Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham about the act of murder and the family's plan to start traveling throughout the country, killing people and whole families at random, Susan Atkins had said animatedly, "The more you do it, the better you like it." If Manson has continued to fascinate mainstream America, he has also done so with its fanatical elements. Today, almost every disaffected and morally twisted group in America, from Satanists to neo-Nazi skinheads, has embraced Manson and the poisons of his virulent philosophy. He has become their spiritual icon, the high priest of anti-establishment hatred. As columnist William Buckley put it, Manson has become the nation's leading anti-citizen. Wayne McGuire in Aquarian Journal predicts that sometime in the future, Charles Manson will metamorphose into a major American folk hero. Though Frenchmen will likely stop drinking wine before that happens, Manson is indeed a hero to many on the jagged margins of our culture. However, the Manson t-shirts and Guns N' Roses album show that the attempted apotheosis and romanticizing of Manson is underway. Two screen projects in the works, the British television documentary Manson, The Man, The Media, The Music, and the American full-length feature Manson in the Desert, whose themes divert the viewer's attention from the murders, unfortunately coalesce with this effort. In a 1994 interview, 17-year-old Plus Natalie, the plus indicates a pseudonym, a Satanist, says, "Charles Manson is an idol and role model." The murders happened, she says, because Manson wanted a new government and anarchy to clear out the garbage, the useless people. Her 20-year-old boyfriend, plus Robert, a fellow Satanist with whom she lives in San Francisco, adds about the Tate-LaBianca victims, "I feel that might is right, and whoever isn't prepared to defend their own life shouldn't cry when their life is taken." Plus Willie, a 21-year-old white supremacist, says he got into Manson on the 20th anniversary of the Tate killings when I went to this heavy metal tribute to him. I had already met all the peace and love cult people, and when I ran into the Satan types, I liked all the negative aspects they stood for. So ever since, I've been hanging out with people that support Manson. Willie feels that as a white man, he is the victim of racism in our society, that blacks are like Neanderthals and overpopulating our culture. If Manson got out, He would improve the quality of life. Plus, Alex, a 42-year-old neo-Nazi who has corresponded with Manson for years, says his discovery of Manson can only be compared to his earlier discovery of Adolf Hitler and the National Socialist Party. He calls Manson the foremost revolutionary leader in the world today, and is special by virtue of a 1 in 100 million shot of gene combinations that gives him his ideas, personality, and physical presence. To the extremists, mass murderers like John Wayne Gacy and Jeffrey Dahmer are no more intriguing than they are to the average citizen. They are merely very sick psychopaths who kill for no reason other than to satisfy their unchecked homicidal urges. Though these killers attract inevitable media attention and interest for a while, they have no followers nor anything to say, and if and when they do talk, not even the extremists listen. The only message these homicidal monsters have to give by their violence is horror. Manson and his murders, on the other hand, are downright hip to the extremists. As misdirected as it was, his violence was political, revolutionary, and therein lies his main appeal to those on the fringes. Also, aware of the flat intellect of most mass killers, the extremists admire and are impressed with Manson's unquestioned intelligence, the offbeat and sometimes searing nature of his insights, his enigmatic answers and allusions, and a mental deftness that allows him to speak in riddles, always with an underlying message. In short, they are drawn to the mystery of Manson. While a Manson-esque culture and mystique grow outside his prison walls, Charles Manson, inmate ID number B-33920 and now 59, is incarcerated at Corcoran State Prison in Corcoran, California, a town of approximately 9,000 people located in the San Joaquin Valley of Central California, 60 miles south of Fresno. Corcoran is built on what was once Tulare Lake, home of the Tachi Indians. Transferred from San Quentin's death row to Folsom State Prison near Sacramento on October 6, 1972, Manson was sent to the California Medical Facility at Vacaville on March 20, 1974, back to Folsom on October 22, 1974, back to San Quentin on June 7, 1975, and back to Vacaville on May 11, 1976, where he remained until July 17, 1985, his longest stay at one prison. He returned to San Quentin on July 18, 1985, and was sent to his present location, Corcoran, on March 15, 1989. Tip Kindle, public information officer for the California Department of Corrections, says the reason for all the transfers of Manson is that Manson has been both a disciplinary and a security problem for the department. It would appear that the fame and outlaw reputation Manson acquired far and wide for the Tate LaBianca murders has had a measurable effect upon how he perceives himself, causing him to act much more belligerently behind bars. Though he was never a model prisoner, I could find no reference in his prison records during his many years of incarceration before the murders of any assaultive behavior by him against prison personnel. But Kindle reports that since Manson's conviction for the murders, he has physically assaulted prison staff, striking them with his hands, throwing hot coffee or expectorating on them, etc., 6 times, the last time in February of 1992, and threatened them on numerous other occasions. Altogether, Manson has been found guilty of 59 CDC 115s, California Department of Corrections disciplinary write-ups. For the past year, however, according to an official at Corcoran, Manson has not been disruptive and hasn't gotten into any trouble. Prison counselor Ernest Cauldron observes that Manson has a pattern of cycling in his behavior. There are brief periods of cooperation, and then he turns and threatens staff, particularly the inexperienced, with violent behavior. In 1972 and 1973, while at Folsom, Manson himself was assaulted on 2 separate occasions by fellow inmates. And a California state prison official says that throughout the years, reports have reached prison personnel that one prison gang or another had a contract on Charlie. However, The only known attempt on his life was while Manson was at the California Medical Facility at Vacaville. The primary reason for sending Manson there was not because of the psychiatric facilities, as many imagined, but because it is considered to be the best place in the California correctional system to take care of a special prisoner like Manson. Vacaville, for the most part, houses the weaker segment of the prison population, those who, because of their physical or mental disability, are more apt to be victims than predators behind bars. On September 25, 1984, it was Manson's misfortune to be working in the hobby shop at Vacaville with one Jan Holmstrom, a member of the Hare Krishna religious group serving a life sentence for the 1974 shotgun murder of his father, a Pasadena gynecologist. In an ironic scene reminiscent of the Manson murders, Holmstrom wrote "Baby Killer" in blood on a wall of the family home. Holmstrom doused Manson with paint thinner and then set him on fire, causing second- and third-degree burns to nearly 20% of his body, mostly his face, scalp, and hands. Holmstrom, described by prison officials as a psychiatric case in remission, said he set Manson ablaze because Manson had objected to his Hare Krishna chants and had threatened him for his religious beliefs. He also claimed, "God told me to kill Manson." True solitary confinement does not exist in the California prison system today. Inmates still use the popular term, however, to refer to the situation where no other inmate shares their cell with them, and they are segregated from the general prison population, mingling only with selected prisoners. Manson has spent the majority of his 23 years of incarceration for the Tate LaBianca, Shea, and Hinman murders in this type of housing. At Vacaville in August of 1980, Manson was given his first prison job, gardener and maintenance man for the Protestant chapel. "It's taken me 10 years to get a breath of fresh air," he said. "I'm not about to screw up." Maintaining a clean disciplinary record for close to 2 years, in June of 1982 he was placed, per his request, on the main line, the general prison population. Manson's resolve not to screw up lasted, or the lack of it remained undiscovered, until October 29, 1982, when a hacksaw blade, along with marijuana, was found in his cell. Also, upon his arrival back at San Quentin from Vacaville in 1985, a 4-inch piece of a hacksaw blade was found in his shoe. How does one reconcile Manson's apparent interest in escaping with his desire at Terminal Island in 1967 to stay behind bars? Prison had become his home, he told the authorities back then, and he didn't think he could adjust to the world outside. Even today, I suspect that Manson isn't miserable or even unhappy behind bars. Having spent 42 of his 59 years in jails, reformatories, and prisons, he obviously has become totally institutionalized, and therefore most likely isn't uncomfortable in an incarcerated setting per se. However, after he got out in 1967, he undoubtedly learned to like having a harem of girls. "Up in the Haight, I'm called the gardener. I tend to all the flower children," he had told Squeaky when they first met, "and riding dune buggies up and down the desert, more." Further, like never before, Manson now has to look over his shoulder. He knows that any con who wants to make a name for himself can kill him, and then he becomes famous. A subsequent search of the chapel uncovered 4 bags of marijuana, 100 feet of nylon rope, and a mail-order catalog for hot air balloons. If Manson couldn't hack his way out of prison, he apparently was thinking of flying the coop. In what must be considered a vapid display, prison officials actually asked the state attorney general's office to file possession of marijuana charges against the man serving 9 concurrent life sentences for 9 murders, but saner counsel prevailed, and no charges were filed. While at Vacaville, Manson refused to take part in group psychiatric therapy and largely just played word games with psychiatrists during the individual sessions he consented to. One psychiatric evaluation of Manson made by prison doctors stated, "He has above-average intelligence, and the Rorschach test drawings seem to point to schizophrenia. This doesn't mean his entire performance was schizophrenic. Manson is a passive-aggressive personality with paranoid tendencies. Manson's response? Sure, I'm paranoid. I've had reason to be ever since I can remember, and now I have to be just to stay alive. As for schizophrenia, take anybody off the streets and put them in the middle of a prison and you'll see all kinds of split personalities. I've got 1,000 faces, so that makes me 500 schizophrenics. And in my life I've played every one of those faces, sometimes because people push me into a role, and sometimes because it's better being someone else than me. After spending a short time in the psychiatric ward at Vacaville, Manson was transferred out on the recommendation of a psychiatric report which said he was nothing but a psychiatric curiosity or oddity. Knowing he may well spend the rest of his life in prison, Manson has either boycotted his parole hearings since his first one in 1978, or used them merely as a forum to sermonize or simply have some fun. In 1978, he regaled the parole board with his comments for 3 hours. I'm totally unsuitable for that world out there. I don't fit in at all, a bearded and shaggy-haired Manson allowed in saying he should not be released from prison. But then Manson, never a model of consistency, added, I'm mad. I'm indignant. I'm mad to every bone in my body that I have to come back to the penitentiary when I didn't break no law. Waving his arms in exclamation and half-singing his presentation, Manson said, I'm not your executioner. I'm not your devil and I'm not your God. I'm Charles Manson. Reminding the board he had spent most of his life behind bars, he said, I was born and raised all my life in prison. He told the board he had been asked to come to Scotland, Germany, Australia, but that he wasn't interested. When asked where he would go if released, he responded, I'd go to the desert, talk to the animals, and live off the land. The parole board, in denying parole, said that Manson's crime eclipses the imagination. The following year, Manson sent word from his cell that he had nothing to tell the board and gave his unit sergeant several $100 bills from a Monopoly set and a chance card that said, Advance to go, collect $200, to deliver to the board members. Delighting in talking to reporters covering his parole hearings, he told one, You're in prison more than I am. You've got more rules to live by than I do. I can sit down and relax. Can you? Grabbing another reporter's arm and pressing his mouth close to her ear, he whispered, Do you know a way out of here? If you get me out, we can go to the desert, and I'll show you things that'll blow your mind. At his parole hearing in 1981, Manson, in a T-shirt with a small skull and crossed bones, repeatedly stood, sat down, paced, and interrupted the hearing, frequently shouting at the board members. He told the board, I've been in solitary for 10 years. I ain't got no mind. It's gone, man. I don't understand half the things you're saying. Then, I never really grew up. I went to prison at 9. I don't read or write too good, and I've stayed like a little kid. I stopped thinking in 1954. In 1986, Manson did not appear at his parole hearing, sending the board instead a lengthy written statement. All of the judgments and the blame that is pushed off on me will be reflected back in the fires of the holy war that you call crime, he wrote. I did invoke a balance for life on earth. From behind the time locks of courtrooms and from the worlds of darkness, I did let loose devils and demons with the power of scorpions to torment. I did unseal 7 seals and 7 jars in accord with the judgments placed upon me. You've drugged me for years, dragging me up and down prison hallways, laying my head on every chopping block you've got, chained me, burnt me, but you cannot defeat me. In the all that was said about me, it was not me saying it, and if you see a false prophet, it is only a reflection of your own judgments. That same year he wrote President Ronald Reagan at the White House with this advice, Keep projecting to kids what not to do, and you make the thought in their brains of what can and will be done. Before signing off with, Easy, Charles Manson, he told Reagan, I'm the last guy in line, but I've got all the thoughts for the balance of order and peace with a one-world government if we all are to survive. At his last parole hearing on April 21, 1992, Manson, the defiant swastika still very visible on his forehead, responded to the accusation he had ordered the murders by telling the three-man parole board, now called the Board of Prison Terms, "Everyone says that I was the leader of those people, but I was actually the follower of the children. I didn't break God's law, and I didn't break man's law." As with each of his prior appearances before the board, he did virtually all the talking. The most routine questions launched him into unstoppable stream-of-consciousness lectures that contained references to God, the economy, Rambo, the Queen of England, World Wars I and II, the Pope, J. Edgar Hoover, winos, Vietnam, chess, Christian ethics, General MacArthur, President Truman, ninja warriors, the San Diego Zoo, J. R. Ewing, gangster Frank Costello, and a myriad of other people and subjects, including the relationship between does and bucks and dogs and chickens. And as always, that which he always returns to, the need to stop the destruction of the environment. He told the board they live in a matriarchal world, he in a patriarchal one. You back up to your women. I don't back up to my women. Although the details did not emerge, Manson acknowledged at the hearing that he has been getting $500 for his autograph from people on the outside. Manson also receives 10 cents for every Manson t-shirt sold. In California, the profits of convicted criminals can only be seized if the money-making venture is directly related to the crime. The t-shirts and Manson's song in the Guns N' Roses album do not qualify for seizure. Senate Bill 1330, which is presently before the California legislature, would expand the scope of seizure to include the sale of anything the value of which is enhanced by the notoriety gained from the commission of the crime. However, in 1971, the son of Wojtek Frykowski, one of the five Tate victims, got a $500,000 judgment against Manson and his four co-defendants. As a result of a writ of execution on the judgment, with interest worth $1,200,000 in 1994, in late February of 1994, the son, who lives in Germany, received his first royalty check for $72,000 from the Manson song in the Guns N' Roses album. The board, in finding Manson unsuitable for parole, set 1997 for his next hearing, the maximum time, 5 years, between parole hearings allowed under the California Penal Code. Until her death from cancer in July of 1992, Sharon Tate's mother, Doris, attended most of the parole hearings for Manson and his killers, and was successful in mobilizing national support in the form of 352,000 letters to the parole board to keep Manson and the others behind bars for life. "I live with her," Sharon's screams, "and her begging for the life of her baby," she often said. In the late 70s, Mrs. Tate co-founded the Los Angeles chapter of Parents of Murdered Children, a group providing mental, emotional, and other support to its members. Just before her death, Mrs. Tate, who was the United States representative at an international victims' rights conference in Stockholm in June of 1990, formed the Sacramento-based Doris Tate Crime Victims Bureau. The bureau promotes, among other things, the enactment of legislation for the rights of crime victims. Since her mother's passing, Patty Tate, who was 11 years old when her 26-year-old sister was slain, and who bears a striking resemblance to Sharon, has been faithfully and effectively carrying on all of her mother's important work. Speaking of her sister, a misty-eyed Patty says, "She was so sweet and such a gentle soul. I idolized her, and there wasn't anything I wouldn't have done for her." Corcoran is a medium maximum security institution. Manson is housed in the Security Housing Unit, SHU, in a 6.5 by 12.5 foot cell he shares with another inmate. Called a prison within a prison, SHU is the maximum security section at Corcoran. Manson is issued 3 meals a day by correctional officers. The food is served on trays through a food port located in each cell door. Breakfast is at 6:30 a.m., lunch at noon, and dinner at 5 p.m. No less than 10 hours a week he exercises in a nearby walled yard with 10 co-inmates of his. Manson has a radio and television set in his cell, but does not have his beloved guitar, the latter not permitted in SHU. Like all inmates in this unit, he does not have a work assignment. Per the California Department of Corrections, the current annual cost to the taxpayers for housing Manson is $20,525. Manson carries on running correspondence with as many of the people who write to him as he can. He also apparently writes to some who have no desire to be his pen pal, sending 4 letters to me in the preceding years. In 1986, the book Manson in His Own Words, as told to Newell Emmons, was published in hardcover. The thoughts may be Manson's, but the diction clearly is not. Dedicated to destroying a myth, Manson instead tries to perpetuate the myth he and his most ardent followers invented, that the Tate-LaBianca murders were the girl's idea. Manson admits, in a roundabout fashion, that he thereafter ordered the 2 LaBianca killings, but continues to deny ordering the 5 Tate murders on the first night. Near the conclusion of his book, Manson writes, "There are days when I get caught up in being the most notorious convict of all time. In that frame of mind, I get off on all the publicity, and I'm pleased when some fool writes and offers to off some pigs for me. I've had girls come to visit me with their babies in their arms and say, 'Charlie, I'd do anything in the world for you. I'm raising my baby in your image.' Those letters and visits used to delight me, but that's my individual sickness. What sickness is it that keeps sending me kids and followers? It's your world out there that does it. I don't solicit my mail or ask anyone to come and visit me. Yet the mail continues to arrive, and your pretty little flowers of innocence keep showing up at the gate." From these relatively benign words, Manson abruptly changes, and after saying he doesn't think he'll ever be released, closes his book in vintage fashion with these ominously ambiguous words: "My eyes are cameras. My mind is tuned to more television channels than exist in your world, and it suffers no censorship. Through it, I have a world and the universe as my own. So, know that only a body is in prison. At my will, I walk your streets and am right out there among you." Life behind bars hasn't dashed Manson's desire to be a recording star. From his cell in Vacaville in 1982, Manson recorded his 2nd album, titled Charlie Manson's Good Time Gospel Hour. Manson sings ballads he composed about his life and that of his pals on San Quentin's death row. The sounds of nearby television and flushing toilets can be heard in the background. Manson's 1st album, called Lie, the photo on the jacket is the one of him on the December 19, 1969 cover of Life magazine, was taped, portentously, on August 9, 1968, exactly 1 year before the Tate murders. With several of the Manson family girls providing choral backup, Manson sings his own compositions. Both albums have gone through several bootleg editions and are considered such rare collectibles that one alternative music store owner told me if he ever got his hands on either one, I wouldn't sell them. They're too valuable. Remarkably, there are some who heap scalding criticism on those in the music industry who never gave Manson a chance when he got out of prison in 1967. If he had been given a real opportunity, they add, most likely the murders would never have taken place. While this is possibly true, that type of but-for causation could be used to argue that if someone had bought Hitler's paintings in Vienna in 1912, perhaps we wouldn't have had the Second World War. Being behind bars also hasn't inhibited Manson from reaching America's vast television audience. The media, NBC's Today Show, CNN, BBC, Charlie Rose, Tom Snyder, the ABC special in March of 1994, etc., have sought him out, enabling him to verbally spew his venom. In a 1988 interview with Geraldo Rivera, he said, "I'm going to chop up some more of you motherfuckers. I'm going to kill as many of you as I can. I'm going to pile you up to the sky. I figure about 50 million of you. I might be able to save my trees and my air and my water and my wildlife." When Rivera later said, "There's 9 dead people out there," referring to Manson's 9 murder convictions, Manson answered, "There's a lot more than 9, son, a whole lot, and there's going to be a whole lot more." When Rivera asked if he told the women in his family to kill, he responded, "I don't deal with women. I got to tell what to do. They know what to do." He told Rivera, "I make laws. I'm the lawmaker. I'm the one that lays down the track." In the 25 years since the murders, no event thrust the Manson family back into the news once again as much as Lynette Squeaky Frum's attempted assassination of President Gerald Ford in 1975. After Manson was transferred from San Quentin back to Folsom in October of 1974, Squeaky and Sandra Good moved to Sacramento, 15 miles to the west, to be as close to him as possible. Though Squeaky and Sandra were not allowed to visit or even correspond with Manson, a prison spokesman at the time said that the two of them would come to the prison about once a month to inquire about how Manson was doing. A friend of Squeaky and Sandra told Time magazine that the girls believed Manson's imprisonment was part of a grand design, that he would rise again someday like Christ. They spend all their time preparing themselves for the day he rises. Squeaky, Sandra, and a part-time nurse they had recruited into the family named Susan Murphy rented a run-down attic apartment in an old downtown boarding house just a few blocks from the state capitol. On the sunny and crisp morning of September 5th, 1975, President Ford was walking through a park in front of the Capitol to meet Governor Jerry Brown. Not only wasn't Squeaky on the Secret Service's list of dangerous people in town to watch, particularly remarkable when weeks earlier she and Sandra had issued a communique to the media in Sacramento that if Nixon's reality wearing a new face, i.e. Ford, continues to run this country against the law, your homes will be bloodier than the Tate-LaBianca homes and me and Lai put together. But the president's men inexplicably paid no attention to an elfish woman nearby attired in a bright red robe and matching turban. The Manson family's hatred of former President Nixon stems, of course, from Nixon's headline-capturing declaration during the trial that he believed Manson to be guilty. In author Ed Sandler's best-selling book, The Family, he quotes a Manson therapist at Vacaville as saying Manson believed his own personal hex on Nixon had caused him to fall. As Ford stopped at a magnolia tree to shake hands with a cluster of smiling supporters, Squeaky materialized out of the group, grabbed a gun from under her robe, and pointed it at Ford, just 2 feet away. Instantly, Secret Service agent Larry Boondorf seized Squeaky's gun arm and threw her to the ground. In apparent anger, Squeaky cried out, "It didn't go off. Can you believe it? It didn't go off." The reason it didn't go off will probably never be known beyond all doubt. To be sure, Squeaky's .45 caliber Army Colt pistol, though loaded with 4 bullets, had no bullet in the chamber ready to be fired. To fire the gun, Squeaky would have first had to pull the slide back on top of the gun to raise a cartridge from the magazine into the firing chamber, which she hadn't done. Had Squeaky mistakenly thought that squeezing the trigger, Boondorf and another witness reported hearing a metallic clicking sound, which could have been the hammer striking the rear of the firing pin, would be enough to fire the weapon? Because of the belief that Squeaky knew how to operate guns, on the documentary Manson, she is seen operating the bolt of a rifle. Many people, including some in law enforcement, are convinced she had no intention of hurting Ford. Nevertheless, Prosecutor Duane Keyes, now a Superior Court judge in Fresno, told me he is absolutely positive she had every intent to kill the president. a state of mind the prosecution had to prove to secure a conviction. In any event, Squeaky was now competing for the limelight, at least for a while, with her god, Charlie, making the September 15, 1975 covers of Newsweek and Time magazines. At her federal trial, she was so obstreperous the judge had her removed from the courtroom for most of the proceedings, but not before she told him that one of the issues at the trial was as clear as the piano in the front window of your home, an accurate reference. During jury deliberations, after a 3-week trial in which Squeaky did not testify, a lot of people, juror Robert Convoy recalled, believed that with no cartridge in the chamber, the gun wasn't a weapon. Ultimately, however, the jury found Squeaky guilty of attempting to assassinate Ford. Prior to 1965, presidential assassination was only a state, not a federal crime. The first female in American history so charged and convicted. Squeaky was sentenced to life imprisonment. Was Manson behind the attempt? My instincts from the beginning were that he was not. Though Manson always spoke as if he had no fear of death, telling his followers that death wasn't the end of life, just another high, even beautiful. Living is what scares me. Dying is easy, he'd also say, as well as implying he had been resurrected. I saw firsthand how hard he in fact fought for his life during his 9 1/2 month trial. Having his death sentence removed just 3 years earlier, it made no sense to me that he would risk a new sentence of death against someone as remote to him and his interests as Ford. Prosecutor Keyes also believed that Manson was not involved, and his office found no evidence implicating him. Squeaky, the little orphan Annie-looking matriarch of the family during Manson's forced exile, was probably trying to impress Manson by her act. She had to know that successful or not in killing Ford, such a spectacular, grandly anti-societal act would be sure to please him. Searching Squeaky's apartment pursuant to a warrant after the attempt on Ford, police found a stack of letters, ready to go, from the International People's Court of Retribution, an impressive-sounding organization whose membership, however, was rather limited. Squeaky, Sandra Good, and Susan Murphy. The letters threatened named corporate executives and U.S. government officials with death if they did not forthwith stop polluting the air and water and destroying the environment. A long list of other addressees was nearby. While on bail after her and Murphy's arrest for conspiring to send threatening communications through the United States mail, Good proceeded to utter, on radio and TV, the same threats, constituting 4 new federal violations of transmitting death threats by way of interstate commerce. Good represented herself at her trial, was convicted on all 5 counts, Murphy on only the conspiracy count, and asked that she be sentenced to the maximum of 25 years. The judge gave her 15. William Shubb, her appointed advisory counsel during the trial, and now a U.S. federal district court judge in Sacramento, says that if she had been agreeable, he is certain a plea could have been negotiated wherein her sentence would have been much less severe. All of Manson's co-defendants in the Tate-LaBianca murders are, like Manson, still behind bars serving their life sentences. Charles Tex Watson, Manson's chief lieutenant at the murder scenes and the principal killer of the Tate-LaBianca victims, has renounced Manson and is presently at Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California. He was transferred there in April of 1993 from the California Men's Colony, CMC, in San Luis Obispo, where he had been incarcerated since September 1972. At CMC in 1975, Watson, through the ministry of Raymond Hoekstra, a legendary prison evangelist known as Chaplain Ray, became a born-again Christian. As a student chaplain and associate administrator of the Protestant chapel at CMC, Watson baptized, led Bible study groups, and preached to the inmate congregation. In 1980, Watson founded Abounding Love Ministries, ALMS, a California nonprofit corporation which he and his Norwegian wife, Kristen, run. The two married in 1979 and have three children. Ordained as a minister in 1983, Watson receives donations to his ministry of approximately $1,500 per month from people on a national mailing list to whom he sends religious cassette tapes and a Christian newsletter. Watson's 1978 book, Will You Die For Me?, which he wrote with Chaplain Ray, chronicles his life with Manson, the murders, and his ultimate conversion to Christianity. Speaking of Manson, to whom he writes, I had given myself totally. He says he served the power of death and destruction through one diabolical man who wanted to be God. Believing that Manson was, perhaps still is, possessed by the devil, he says Manson's only interest had been death, but Jesus promised life. A rather startling admission by Watson to his prison psychiatrist was revealed at his last parole hearing in May of 1990. Watson elected to waive his January 1993 parole hearing, stipulating to his unsuitability for parole. The psychiatrist wrote that it had only been during the last 3 years of one-on-one therapy that Watson had begun to truly experience a sense of deep remorse, both for the crime victims and for the families of the crime victims. When a troubled parole board member asked Watson what, then, had he been feeling the previous 18 years, Watson responded, "Well, it's not that I haven't experienced that before, but there's been things happening in my life over the last few years that have really brought it home more so." Watson explained that ever since he became a Christian in 1975, it's been great to know that I have been forgiven by God for what I've done. But I think sometimes we can hide behind that. In the last 3 years, I've had the opportunity to really see myself in a new light, in the sense that I've opened myself up to really look at the crime through other people's eyes, other than just my own. Watson's belated epiphany was brought about in large part, he informed the board, by a somewhat incongruous relationship with Suzanne LaBerge, formerly Suzanne Struthers, Rosemary LaBianca's daughter from a relationship before she met Lino. The thrice married and divorced Suzanne, who was 21 years old at the time of the murders, began visiting Watson at CMC in 1987. She appeared at the 1990 parole hearing and actually made an impassioned plea for the release of her mother's killer, telling the board Watson had atoned for his terrible crimes, had overcome his past by turning to Christ, and no longer was a threat to society. In a June 5, 1994 letter to me, Watson wrote, "With my deepest remorse, I apologize to the people of the world for my part in making Manson what he has become. To the many victims, my heart is full of sorrow for my actions. If anyone should have received the death penalty for their crimes, it was me. I believe that God and His grace gave me a second chance, having a different plan for my life. I have no great ambitions other than allowing the Lord to use me as a testimony, urging others to Christ." While at CMC, Watson completed courses in vocational data processing and office machine repair. His current work assignment at Mule Creek is tier tender, i.e., keeping clean one of the two tiers in the building where he is housed. A prison spokesperson at Mule Creek advises that since Watson's incarceration for the Tate-LaBianca murders, he has received one disciplinary infraction of a minor nature in 1973. He continues to program without incident. Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten, like Watson, have each renounced Manson and expressed remorse for the killings. All are still at the California Institution for Women at Frontera. One of only three prisons for women in the state, Frontera has been described by one wag as a college campus with barbed wire around it. Each of the three Manson girls lives in a cottage-like housing unit, two inmates to a unit, at the attractive, well-manicured institution. All three girls have been reviewed for parole consideration and denied 10 times thus far. It is the common consensus that if any of them are ever released, Van Houten will be the first one, primarily because, unlike Atkins and Krenwinkel, she was only involved in the LaBianca, not the Tate murders. Additionally, a well-organized group, Friends of Leslie, consisting of hundreds of supporters, regularly urge her release to the parole board. According to a prison spokesperson, the institutional behavior of the girls is viewed as good. Krenwinkel, in fact, has not received one disciplinary write-up in 23 years, called unusual by a member of the parole board. Their current custody level is medium security. They are each in the general prison population, and reportedly Krenwinkel and Van Houten are closer to each other socially than either one is to Atkins. The most well-known of the girls, Susan Sexy Sadie Atkins, converted to Christianity even before Watson. Through the intercession in early 1974 of former family member Bruce Davis, in prison at Folsom for the Hinman Shea murders, Susan began to contemplate a Christian life. Davis, who had become a born-again Christian, wrote many letters to her, offering guidance and recommending Christian literature, including the New Testament, for her to read. In her 1977 book, Child of Satan, Child of God, written with Bob Slosser, she recounts an evening in late September 1974 when, alone in her cell, she softly but solemnly uttered the words that she wanted to be forgiven for her ghastly crimes. Suddenly, she writes, there in my thoughts was a door. It had a handle. I took hold of it and pulled. When the door opened, she says, a flood of brilliant light poured over her. In the center was an even brighter light, which she knew was Jesus. He spoke to me, literally, plainly, in my 9x11 prison cell. Susan, I am really here. I'm coming in your heart to stay. Right now you are being born again. You are now a child of God. You are washed clean, and your sins have all been forgiven. Atkins goes on to say that that night, for the first time in many years, she slept soundly, free of nightmares, unafraid and warm. On the last page of her book, she writes that she believes the Lord will one day release me from this place, Frontera, and give me a ministry to people of all kinds, but especially those who are as twisted and lost as I was from my earliest teen years. She now denies stabbing Sharon Tate, adding, however, that her moral culpability is still the same because she was there and did nothing to stop it. When she was asked by a reporter in the mid-80s if she would be willing to say she was sorry to Sharon Tate's mother for her involvement in Sharon's murder, she replied, "There are no words to describe what I feel. I'm sorry. Please forgive me. Those words are so overused and inadequate for what I feel." Atkins married one Donald Lee LeJour, a 52-year-old Texan, in September of 1981. LeJour spells his last name with a dollar sign for the S. At the time of the marriage, he claimed to be worth $999 million plus, and seven times that in foreign countries, and he said he planned to build a $12 million solar home near the Frontera prison so he could be close to his bride. Per news reports, LeJour appeared for the wedding in the prison chapel, resplendent and bespangled in diamond rings, diamond clips, a huge gold belt buckle, sunglasses, cigar, Western-style hat, and an orange leisure suit. Atop his rust-colored Cadillac in the prison parking lot outside was an unfurled Lone Star flag of the state of Texas. Although Susan had corresponded with LeJour for several years, there were two small details she regrettably had not learned about him. His wealth was non-existent. Perhaps more importantly, LeJour had the troubling habit of getting married about as often as Paris changes skirt lengths. Susan was his 36th bride. 3 months later, she told LeJour, who had had conjugal visits with her in the prison family living unit apartments, to go back to Texas, concluding the marriage was a drastic mistake. LeJour filed for divorce the following year. In 1987, Susan remarried. Her husband, 15 years her junior, attends law school in Southern California. She describes this marriage as the first healthy and successful relationship I've ever had in my life. In a long typewritten letter to me on May 11, 1994, Atkins wrote, 25 years ago, you tried three girls between the ages of 20 and 22 years old, and one 35-year-old ex-con. Now, 25 years later, there are three women about the age of 45, all of whom have exemplary prison records, have taken advantage of the educational programs to earn college degrees, have contributed to every charity organization and program available, and have expressed remorse, shame, and regret for their parts in this hideous crime. And you have one 60-year-old ex-con who shows up at his parole board hearings with a swastika carved on his forehead. I think that says it all. Though Atkins is very critical of Manson, she has said she still prays for him, that Charlie will turn to Christ. Atkins has obtained, through correspondence, an Associate of Arts degree, 2 years, graduating with a 3.5 grade point average. She also has completed a course in vocational data processing and is presently taking paralegal classes. Her current work assignment at Frontera is that of a sewing operator in the Prison Industries program. In 1976, Leslie Van Houten's conviction for the two LaBianca murders was reversed and sent back for a new trial by the California Court of Appeal, 2nd Appellate District, on the ground that Judge Charles Older had erred in not granting her motion for a mistrial when her attorney, Ronald Hughes, vanished near the end of the trial. After a hung jury in the first retrial, she was finally reconvicted of the two murders in 1978. As opposed to the guilt phase of her original trial back in 1970 to 71, in her two retrials, Van Houten readily admitted to the jury her full participation in the LaBianca homicides. Her defense was diminished mental capacity based on mental illness induced in part by the chronic, prolonged use of hallucinogenic drugs. For a few months before her last trial, she was released on a $200,000 bail bond paid for by friends and relatives, and lived for a while with a former writer from the Christian Science Monitor who was writing a book about Van Houten. The book reached the first draft level, but was never published. Van Houten had a short-lived marriage to a man named Bill Cywin in the early 80s. Though not connected to any misbehavior or complicity on her part, during the brief marriage, Cywin was found to be in possession of a female prison guard's uniform. Through correspondence courses, Van Houten acquired a Bachelor of Arts degree in English literature. She also writes short stories, one of which was included in an anthology of prison literature, and at one time edited the prison newspaper. She is part of a small inmate group that sews quilts for the homeless. Van Houten says she takes offense to the fact that Manson doesn't own up to his responsibility for the murders. I take responsibility for my part, and part of my responsibility was helping to create him. Being a follower does not excuse. Van Houten is presently doing secretarial work at the prison. Patricia Krenwinkel received a Bachelor of Science degree through correspondence while at Frontera, and has also completed a course in vocational data processing. Krenwinkel has never married. The most athletic of the three Manson girls, she plays on the prison softball team and presently is a camp trainer in the inmate firefighters program, training those under her to meet a physical fitness standard they must have in order to fight fires. Both she and Van Houten serve as counselors in a program in which young people with drug abuse problems are brought to the prison. In 1988, while stating her deep remorse for the murders, Krenwinkel nonetheless told her prison psychiatrist that Abigail Folger, the person she murdered on the night of the Tate murders, could have been something more than she was, a drug abuser. At her 1993 parole hearing, Krenwinkel, crying and her voice cracking, told the board, "No matter what I do, I cannot change 1 minute of my life. There's nothing I can do outside of being dead to pay for this. And I know that's what you wish. But I cannot take my own life." In the 1994 ABC special, she said that every day I wake up and know that I'm a destroyer of the most precious thing, which is life. And living with that is the most difficult thing of all. But, she adds, that's what I deserve, to wake up every morning and know that. Responding to Manson's claim he did not order the murders, she said, Charlie is absolutely lying. There wasn't one thing done that was even allowed to be done without his express permission. She is very concerned about young people who write her and seem to think that what we did was all right. There is nothing, nothing that we did that is all right. Nothing. If there is anything I can say to these children, it's that he, Manson, is not the man to follow.